and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, our series of lectures from the Alaska Botanical Garden 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference continues with garden writer Jeff Lowenfels. His talk entitled Teeming with Microbes was recorded at the UAA APU Consortium Library on March 12th.
This is the talk that I give when I go to the lower 48 states and people think I'm an expert. You know, 50 miles away, you come into town, you're an expert. Here, everybody knows I'm not, so we'll just kind of have some fun with it. This talk I've probably given a couple hundred times this year alone to garden clubs and master gardeners and college classes and all sorts of stuff. And I always tell people, don't take notes, buy the book. That's where all the notes are, so you don't have to worry about it. I apologize if I just sort of hesitate because I gave this 3 years ago, so I'm always so embarrassed to do it again. But when I started gardening, Ricky Nelson was mowing the lawn, and Opie was, picking the strawberry patch instead of directing movies, and she was dropping her chicken on the ground, and we didn't own our own telephones. They all had dials on them, no buttons. Television sets had dials on them, no buttons. We had lots and lots of different kinds of newspapers, usually two newspapers for every locality, and a magazine for anything you'd ever want to do, including gardening. Lots and lots and lots of gardening magazines. Jiffy Pop and aluminum foil kind of things, TV dinners came into play because this was a time of aluminum products. Lots of plastic became every day out of nowhere. We had plastic coming out of the yin-yang when I was a kid growing up. And all of a sudden, these brand new wonderful fertilizers appeared in the early 50s, and they were new, and they were soluble, and they were going to change the way we gardened and change the way we grew our food, and we got pesticides from World War II so we could get rid of boll weevils and all the terrible things that were eating our crops. Instant coffee was invented. Has a lot to do with gardening, doesn't it? And it was a time that was called Better Living Through Chemistry. Of course, some of us in our generation took it a little bit too far. I'm laughing because I knew that was coming, obviously. Mr. Wizard was on TV, and you watched Mr. Wizard if you were science-minded, and he had this little dweeby young lady who would, do all sorts of stuff. Let's see where it goes. Today, of course, we have popcorn. So today, that's popcorn, no Jiffy Pop. People don't know what Jiffy Pop is if you ask a kid. No aluminum foil in the TV dinner, goes right in the microwave oven. This is our instant coffee. And our telephones, we all own them, and they have a television set right in them. So that's kind of an amazing thing. And when we want information, we can get it anytime at any place. And I always say Google is the gardener's best friend, and you can get Google anywhere. It's a terrific thing. But many people, even though it's 2011, and even though you would think twice about eating the food if a wedding invitation came to you and said, great wedding, blah, blah, blah. And incidentally, we're going to be serving food that's been sprayed with the latest and greatest pesticides. We use incredibly high non-organic fertilizers. And there's some stuff that's all genetically modified that you're going to really enjoy at the wedding. And you'd go and you'd think twice about whether you're going to eat. And yet, when it comes to our own gardens, a lot of people are still using the same old fertilizers. And, it's the same stuff. It's just advertised differently and different package on it. All our food's still being sprayed. Genetically modified organisms all over the place. Incidentally, they discovered reported a new micro fungus that they've never seen before that only associates with GMO and Roundup. And it's that would be fine, except for the fact that this happens to be affecting mammalian breeding on farms. So we're going to see some interesting stuff. So we're stuck. We're just stuck. And we know there's a better way to do it. We know that organic is better. It's just a little bit too expensive in the supermarket. But gee, growing it at home doesn't cost any more. In fact, it's cheaper growing it at home. And really, everybody should be an organic gardener. Now, I've been a garden writer here for, 36 years and 17 weeks and never missed a week. And I used to be the biggest proponent of Miracle-Gro. 23 chemicals have been removed from the market since I started writing the column, and things that I've been recommending over the years. I used to argue with my fellow garden writers at the annual convention. I used to bet them that they couldn't tell me that there was a difference between a brown manure nitrogen or a green powder nitrogen. All nitrogen's nitrogen. Look at the periodic table, it's nitrogen. And the plant didn't care one versus another. It's just nitrogen. Plants don't care. They could take it inorganically or chemically, and or organically. And I'd always win the argument because nobody could convince anybody why one was better than the other. And I would always say, if you get some good proof, I will change my ways and be a big proponent of organic gardening. And one day a friend of mine sends me this picture. This is a nematode, and the words "you lose" were on it, and the words "the soil food web" were on it. My wife was at Yale getting a quasi-degree in art, and so I was home alone, and I spent 48 hours drilling through the internet to try to figure out what this picture was. This was back in about 1996 or 7. And I couldn't figure out what it was. It turns out it's a blind nematode. All nematodes are blind. Nematodes are true worms. They travel in the soil at a temperature gradient where they're going to bump into the thing that they want to eat. And this guy's traveling at a temperature gradient. You know, if it was in Alaska, it'd be right at the top of the soil. Traveling along, and all of a sudden, smells this tomato root here, this white stuff. And then smells this wonderful pheromone that's coming from this single fungal hyphae that's protecting that tomato root, protecting it, because when this guy swims through the first one, swims through the second one, the next thing you know, you get pressure right there by the nematode. They fill up with water, those two little things, and that squeezes the nematode to death. It's dead in a couple of seconds. That fungal hyphae is protecting the root. Now, at the time in 1996, I was writing a column for about 25 years. I'd never seen anything like this. I'd never seen a nematode up close like this. A single fungal hyphae, nonetheless one that had the ability to strangle an animal, just blew me away. But I didn't know what the word soil food web was, so once I figured out that was a nematode, I went and started to drill on the soil food web. And finally, I found a diagram by a woman named Dr. Elaine Ingham in 1988. This was the first reference that I could find. I've since been able to find one from 1972, a paper written by a guy who was a grad student, and he submitted the paper, and it was all about the soil food web, a word he claims to have invented, and he shows it when he gives talks, and he shows it with a big F on it because he flunked, because the professor had never heard of the soil food web. So it's a relatively new thing. Dr. Elaine Ingham is now, just this month, has been appointed the head research scientist for Rodale Institute, so it's going to be very interesting to see some of the things. But when this came out, I didn't know what the heck I was looking at. I mean, I knew what the fungi was, but I didn't know what I couldn't even pronounce that word. And then it had all these things in here, and you know, I'm a garden writer, and I'm supposed to know this stuff, and I'm pretty embarrassed about it. So I go to my next garden writers meeting, and I ask people there, 800 garden writers, how many people know what a mycorrhizal fungi is? Not one person in 1996 or 7 raised their hand. Nobody knew what they were. How many people know what the soil food web was? Not one garden writer. New York Times, Victory Garden, Southern Victory Garden, you name it. They didn't know. So I didn't feel so bad, but I still couldn't understand what this was, and then I eventually found this a picture of it. This is a soil food web. You have a bunch of soil chains in the soil food web, in the soil. You know, a little guy gets eaten by a bigger guy, gets eaten by a bigger guy. Well, all of these chains are out there, and every now and then one of the guys on the chain looks up and goes, "Hey, I could eat that off of that chain up there," and starts eating off the other chain, or maybe a chain below it, and all of these chains become linked into a gigantic web. And that's what a soil food web is. And it starts with the plant itself. The plant, 50 to 70% of its energy, photosynthetic energy, is used to develop things that drip out of the roots, not to grow the tomato or the leaves or the flower, but to produce something called exudates. And you're sitting here right now exudating. You're sweating. That's human exudate. And just like you, the exudate for the plant attracts bacteria and fungus. And they attract bacteria and fungus because the soil is inherently low in carbon. And the area right around the root zone, because of these exudates, which contain tremendous amounts of carbon, is much higher. And so they attract the bacteria and the fungi to the root zone. The plants grow growing. It's sloughing off some cells from the roots as they grow. They also contain carbon. So the area right around the root, the rhizosphere, is richer in carbon than the area further out, and you have a great population of bacteria and fungi eating this stuff and being very happy, and they're attracted by the plant's exudates, basically. Okay. Incidentally, well, we'll talk about your exudate in a couple minutes, but what happens is the bacteria and fungi, they get fat and happy, they multiply, they get great numbers, and along come the things that eat them on the chain, nematodes and protozoa. They eat the bacteria and fungi right there in the rhizosphere for the carbon that the bacteria and fungi have accumulated in their bodies. And they eat a little bit of the nitrogen and some of the other stuff that's in them, but basically most of the nitrogen that's there is excreted by the fungi, by the nematodes and the protozoa in plant usable form as nitrogen. And the plant takes it up, and that's how the plant feeds itself. Exudate attracts the bottom of the food web, who in turn get eaten. The extractment from that eating turns out to have lots of nitrogen in it that feeds the plant, and that's how plants feed themselves. That's how all these plants out here that aren't getting Miracle-Gro feed themselves. That's how all plants would feed themselves if we would let them do so. And then, of course, what happens is, you know, the nematodes get eaten by mites and other worms come in and eat the protozoa. And so you get this gigantic food web. And we're going to talk about it a little bit more extensively. Don't take notes. The book is there. You can read it. In order to understand this, though, you got to look through my weird eyes because I don't have an electron microscope. And we're gonna pretend that this is a plant in Town Square on June 21st. That's the roots of the plant, okay? And that plant sitting there, it's a long day, and all these tourists are taking its picture, and it's, you know, God, I'm hungry. I'd like some Mexican, nope, let's make that Japanese food. And so what the plant does is it produces an exudate that drips out of the root system, we'll turn them upside right, drips out of the root system, and the next thing you know, you have Japanese bacteria.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And so that's how the system works. And the plant is in control. See, now you're a gardener, you'd like to think you're in control, but in fact, the plant's in control. And if it wanted Mexican food, it would change the exudate to attract slightly different bacterial mix and microbial mix and get different kinds of food. And if the plant wants American food, you know, chromium, it could do the same thing, change the exudate. If it wants something great to drink, like a beer, no. Plants don't like alcohol. 1% alcohol touching a root starts to kill those root cells. So alcohol in plants are not a good thing, and I stuck this in here for a reason which will become clear in a couple of minutes. The attraction of bacteria and fungi, and then ultimately the nematodes and the protozoa, is not just for feeding. It's also to get great numbers and diversity, because the numbers and diversity create a situation where the bad guys are kept in check. And what the example I use is, you know, if 3/4 of us were alligators or crocodiles, whatever that happens to be, the rest of us in this room would be in big doo-doo. But they aren't. And, you know, what we've got is diversity in this room. So if we had one crocodile in here, you know, some of us would get up and take care of that crocodile, make sure it didn't kill the rest of us. That's what happens around the root zone. You have this tremendous amount of diversity of organisms that keep each other in check, which is very, very important so that you don't get the bad guys taking over. Now, in a teaspoon of soil right here in Alaska, you might find 500 million to a trillion organisms, which when I wrote the book originally, I claimed were bacteria. Just bacteria. You can't really see them. The reason why you don't really know too much about them is because we can't see them in our high school microscopes. They're very small. This is what they look like under an electron microscope. They come in 3 different shapes, basically. But it turns out, 2 years ago, just before I did the revision, it was discovered that they're not just bacteria in the soil. They're a second organism called archaea. These are the third branch of life. You have animals, you have plants, and you have archaea. They were discovered in 1976. They thought they lived in hot vents and extremophiles, they're called, the volcanic places. And it turns out that, in fact, then they discovered that they're the dominant form of life in the seawater, in the oceans. And then they discovered 2 years ago that they are the dominant form of life involved in nitrogen fixing, even though they don't nitrogen fix. They're involved in nitrogen fixing. This is what makes the methane from the back end of a cow or the stomach. It's these guys, not those guys. They have a different cell wall, different kind of material in it. They look exactly like bacteria most of the time, but they're a completely different form of life. We had no idea they were in the soil in 2006 when the book came out, and now we know that they're very, very important. We're learning more and more and more about them. The bacteria and the archaea have the capability of breaking down the ends of these long carbon chains. You know, if you've ever seen carbon chains, they look, you know, methyl ethyl chicken wire on, you know, with a little, and they can nibble the ends. Simple things to digest. And they eat and they eat and they breed and they breed. This is a mixed audience, so I'm not going to show you the breeding stuff, but if you took two of them, put them in a petri dish that was gigantic, that had ideal conditions in it, you know, in about 6 weeks, we'd have about 6 feet of bacterium all around the Earth. So fortunately, we don't have ideal conditions, but these guys would really take over. They need to have water in order to live. We water our plants almost probably 70% to keep the microbiology alive in the roots, not for the plant itself. If they're not alive and active, if they're dormant, they're not feeding the plant. So it's very important they water. And there's some very important bacteria. These are the ones that give soil its smell, that nice smell in compost. It comes from, it's called geosim. And it comes from actinomycetes, which are a special kind of bacteria that form these very special colonies. They're very, very photogenic, and they contain all sorts of antibiotics. And so when they're attracted to the root zone, they're not only getting eaten and therefore feeding the plant because of the poop resulting, but they're letting off antibiotics, keeping some of the bad guys away, et cetera. These are the antibiotics that we use to keep well, streptomycin and all that kind of stuff. And in England, where they're not, the kids aren't playing outside, they've done studies, because they don't have their hands in the dirt, they're not being exposed to these antibiotics and they're getting sick. So it's not happening. All right, now, from a gardener's perspective, they produce bacteria, a slime. You get up in the morning and brush your teeth because you have a bacterial slime on your teeth, and you're all licking your teeth right now. It happens always, every time. This bacteria, this is what it looks like. It's formed by the bacteria in order to protect themselves and enable them to stick together. They form a it forms a coating on top of them, this bacterial slime. And this means that the protozoa, for example, that want to eat the bacteria have a little bit of a tough time to get in at them, but it also sticks to other things like little bits of soil. And so you begin to get soil structure when these bacterially slimed colonies stick to soil, and then they stick, the soil sticks to each other, and you begin to get little soil structure just on these little teeny bacteria. And this slime has a pH above 7, okay? Don't worry about pH scale and all that garbage. It's not an acid. It's the opposite of an acid, okay? And when you have soils that are dominated by bacteria, soils can either be dominated by bacteria or they can be dominated by fungi. Dominated by bacteria, if you took all the bacterium that were in an acre of land, you'd have about 2 cows worth of bacterium. That's a lot of bacteria. But when it's dominated by bacterium, the soil will have a pH above 7. If it's dominated by fungi for a reason I'm going to show you, the pH is lower than 7. There are good bacteria, but there are definitely bad bacteria, and you want to have the diversity in order to keep the good bacteria in check. You have the fungi. Now, for years, everybody thought fungi were nothing more than plants that had chlorophyll in them. But it turns out they're completely different from plants. In fact, the way they process carbon is much more like animals. They're more related to animals than they are to plants. They have no chlorophyll. They have chitin in their cell walls. That's the same thing that's in the king crab and lobsters. And they're completely different organisms. So they're literally related to us more than they are to plants. The thing about them is that they don't make their own carbon, and so they have to go get their carbon, and they do that by growing into their carbon sources. What I've got here is some Alaskan soil. I've taken baby oatmeal, I've mixed it with this Alaskan soil, I put it in a yogurt cup, I put it in my furnace room at 80 degrees, I make sure I wipe off the moisture once a night, and after 3 days, in that teaspoon of soil, which started out with 14, 16, 17 feet of invisible fungal hyphae, they grew and multiplied, eventually thousands and millions of them formed these individual threads. Those are, you know, thousands of individual fungal hyphae that have come together, and they form mycelium. And they weave through the soil, and you can drop this soil on the ground, and it stays in its shape. I should have brought some here because I can't take it anywhere. The TSA hates this when they go in my luggage. And so what happens is, first of all, you get soil structure from those bacterium sticking to the sides of stuff, and then you've got these single fungal hyphae, and then later on those mycelium, weaving through these stuck together bacterial pieces and creating soil aggregates. And they're not bricks, they're not flat. You know, so when they stick together, they have pore spaces in them that allows the bad air to be pushed out. When water comes in, water can be stored in there. The little microbes can hide in there from the bigger microbes. This is where soil structure comes from. Teeny little bacterium and teeny little fungi. So it's pretty cool stuff. Now, when the fungi grow, the bacteria, you know, traveling from here to here for a bacterium, that's like a trip around the world 15 times. The fungi can grow 40 centimeters a minute. I mean, they're just incredible. The biggest organisms on the face of the earth are fungi. There's always a fight between Oregon and Michigan. Who has the biggest one? Is it 300 miles? Is it 380 miles? They're gigantic. They open up the tips of their bodies, of their hyphae. They add more bricks in as they continue to grow. They leak out little bits of acid to break down stuff which they can bring in through their cell walls, and then they continue growing, leaving that acid there. So pH of below 7 because the acid that's dropped out, and when fungal dominance occurs in soil, the pH has a pH below 7. They break down complicated, complex, really hard to eat carbon things as opposed to bacterium, so bark chips, all sorts of tough things to do. This is one of my favorite slides. This is a single fungal hyphae in a time slot, okay? So it's going up this way. And what's happening is this little white spot is beginning to appear as the fungal hyphae becomes active. That little white spot's known as a Spritzenkopper. Spritzenkopper. And the Spritzenkopper is nothing more than a command center, and it activates all the activities, and it controls the activities of the fungi as it's growing, and it gets brighter and brighter and brighter the more growing activity that's going on. And you know, it's just this big command center, and it sort of tells them, bring up some molecules from the south, you know, we got a little hole in the left wall and all that kind of stuff, and the food's over here and all that kind of stuff. It's just a phenomenal thing. And here's how a fungi work. This is a fungus, and this fungus is saying, gee, you know, I'm hungry, I want something complex and carbony, how about a Milky Way, I need a Milky Way. And so it figures out where the Milky Way is, and you can see these things on YouTube where the fungi, it's just going like this. You put the food source over here, and the next thing goes right to the food source. Unbelievable, you can see these things. So it wants the Milky Way, it figures out where the Milky Way is, it grows to the Milky Way, it drips out a little bit of acid as it's growing, it knows it has to break down that Milky Way. Some of that acid stays in the ground, even though it's continuing to grow, helps the bacteria break down, get into the stuff that, you know, it breaks down the acid. But in the meantime, what's it interested in? It wants to take up the nutrient from the Milky Way, which it does, and it brings it down into the hyphae, and it's in the plant. Now, there's two very important kinds of fungal hyphae that we'll talk about a little bit later. Maybe, I don't know where they are in the show. Ecto and endo mycorrhizal fungi. And this is so fundamental, the fact that no garden writer knew what they were in 1996 explains why lots of you may not know about it today. This is how you pronounce the words, mycorrhizal. It wasn't in spell check when I first used it. The Daily News people had got it wrong the first couple of times. I mean, it was just, but that's the fungus, okay? Single fungus. The relationship between the root and the fungus is a mycorrhiza, single relationship. And if there's more than one, it's a mycorrhizae. And so many people, including the guy that sells 90% of these in the United States, on his brochures was using this. And I beat him up badly. And you know how I beat you guys up on fuchsia all the time? Well, I beat him up, and so now he's changed his labels, and it's now mycorrhizal fungi as opposed to mycorrhizae fungi, which is wrong. There are two kinds, the ecto outside. Okay, these always are hardwoods, and you know, we've got on our birch trees and the alders here. Alders actually start out endo and then go later on, they become ecto. They are something that you can always see some form of. And what they do is they form these sheaths around the roots, okay, called a Hartig sheet. And that Hartig sheet has the capability of, in the right conditions, of holding water. So they help the things retain water. But you can see the other things that they do. For example, if you were a little nematode and you wanted to get in here, this gunky, cottony stuff, which is the fungus, would prevent you from doing that. So they protect the plant. This particular ponderosa pine here has mycorrhizal fungi growing off it, extending the reach of the root, enabling the plant to get into areas that it normally couldn't get into. And you can see these in your own yard here in Alaska. The reason why we don't grow maple trees here is because we don't have the mycorrhizal fungi for maple trees here. 10 maple trees came up from Sears Roebuck back in the late 50s. They came up in soil. That soil had the mycorrhizal fungi in it, and they grow. And we have trees around town, maple trees that are kind of like witness trees. And so you, if you see those trees, underneath those trees, the mycorrhizal fungi exist. So if you go over to the, it used to be the Clarion, what do they call it now? The hotel that keeps changing its name on Spinard Road. That maple tree over there, God, it's just seeds like crazy, little seedlings. And if you take them home without the soil, the seedling, after about 5 years, will be about this big. If you give it to your neighbor in soil, like I did, it'll be about this big from the ground up, because it has the mycorrhizal fungi. Fascinating. And I'm convinced oaks, all sorts of things would grow here once we make sure we have the right mycorrhizal fungi. They always form fruiting bodies, mushrooms, truffles. If you don't have the Amanita mascara around your birch trees, that's the mycorrhizal fungi for birch here. Guess what? Your trees are not doing well and will not do well. They must have that mycorrhizal fungi. All right, then there's one that breaks about cellular structure. I usually give this in an hour and a half. So the second kind is the endo, also called VAM, fascicular arbuscular mycorrhizal, okay, VAM. And these are microscopic. You can't see these. They form these tree-like structures, which is where the word comes from, and they reach out and get stuff for the plant and bring it in. Let's see, what do we got here? And you have to dye them in order to be able to see them. So these you can't see, and these are on a lot of your vegetables and grasses and things like that. They form these little vesicles, and the goods are stored in here, and this is the transfer point between the fungi and the plant when it needs to call up on nutrients. Now this is where size does make a difference, because what a root is nothing more than a chemical sponge. Okay, and let's just say that this is the soil. Here's the root growing into the soil. These are all the nutrients in the soil, these colored things. What happens is along the area where the root touches the soil, it uses up what's in the soil. Unless there's a lot of water moisture bringing in new stuff, you end up with a depletion zone. So how does the plant feed itself? It goes deeper. It branches out. It changes its position. Okay, but it's big and fat and ugly, and so what it needs to do is produce some exudates that attract mycorrhizal fungi that are skinny and teeny that can go into little portholes, that can get into places the root could never get into, that can extend out from the root far beyond the depletion zone to get food for the plant, and that's what it does. They go out, they break down phosphorus, which in our soil, that's why 832-16 was used so prevalent by Man Leiser, if you remember him. It's because our phosphorus is locked up like that. And the idea was if you put enough of it in there, by golly, there'd be a little bit left for the plant, and that was right. The problem is we've reached peak phosphorus in the world, and we shouldn't be wasting it. And if you have mycorrhizal fungi, they'll go out and get it for you. You don't need to add phosphorus to our soils ever. It's in the soil. You just need the mycorrhizal fungi to drop the acid out to get it. Mycorrhizal fungi is attracted by the exudates that drip down from the plant that's produced by photosynthesis, blah, 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 blah. Okay. And it brings back copper, and it brings back nitrogen we've discovered, and it brings back zinc, all sorts of things brought back to the plant in return for those exudates. Don't bring back stuff. I'm dead. You're dead. It's a symbiotic relationship. And in the right kind of grass, in that little teaspoon of spore, there are 3 miles of invisible fungal hyphae. Unbelievable stuff. Even more important, they really do reach out, and they really do extend the reach. Those are the roots. These are the fungal hyphae. My goodness gracious. 3 miles, you can see how you get there. And they form the subway system underneath your yard. And if you're a soil food webby, your yard's just completely inundated with mycorrhizal fungi with this little subway system. And they don't live forever. This is my yard. They don't live forever. Actually, that's Tokyo, I think. But they don't live forever. Those poor people. But they branch off, and you get new spores and little propagules and everything else. And when they die, they're full of carbon. So they leave carbon in the soil to feed the other organisms in the soil food web. So it's really a terrific win-win thing. And in fact, which I'm going to explain either now or in a minute, they produce more carbon than anything else you can put in your soil by themselves without you doing a darn thing. We used to think 21% was from humic acids or 27%. This is 37% of the carbon in your soil comes from mycorrhizal fungi that produce it and drip it out. Or gather it and drip it out. It's unbelievable.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with garden writer Jeff Lowenfels. His talk, entitled Teeming with Microbes, was recorded at the Alaska Botanical Garden 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference on March 12, 2011.
Paul Stamets brought this up. These are something called endophytic fungi. I include this now because we're beginning to use these now as gardening products. When you take a plant and look at it, every single plant on the face of the earth, terrestrial, water, seawater, has at least one, some 350 or 60 different kinds of fungi called endophytic fungi. They live, they're not symbiotic, they don't hurt the plant. They live in the plant. Sometimes they do help the plant inadvertently, like in grasses. There's an endophytic fungi in a lot of grasses that prevents grazers, whether the grazers be four-hoofed bison or whether the grazers be little tiny insects. Because of the endophytic fungi, they won't graze. And now scientists are beginning to get these and make products out of them so that you can put them out and you don't get little, you know, grasshoppers in your fields and whatnot. And, it's beginning to come into the gardening scene. They are beautiful when you put them on petri dishes. Absolutely stunning. Paul Stamets does sort of a correlation between the beauty and the use of them. They're just spectacular. They do all sorts of things for plants. We're just beginning to learn about them. The revised copy of the book now has a chapter on endophytic fungi. And they're good fungi and bad guys. And the bad guys, just like in the bacterial situation, hang around waiting for their opportunity. All right, so those are the little guys. How do you know if you got the little guys without a microscope or an expensive test? You see whether you have the bigger guys. And two of the bigger guys are the protozoa. Everybody studied this one. This is a paramecium. You had this in 10th grade. You took home the diagram. There's the gullet. This is what a paramecium looks like under an electron microscope. Completely different animal. Then this is one that everybody said they saw they never did. This is the amoeba. And this is what it looks like today. Now, a paramecium will eat 10,000 bacterium in a day. Poop out the excess, if it's in the rhizosphere, feed the plant. 10,000 bacterium in a day. Amoebas eat bacteria as well. Some of them eat fungi. Then they're nematodes. Nematodes are true worms. They have a mouth, they have an anus, digestive system, and they can eat fungi, they can eat bacteria, they can eat each other. They can eat all sorts of stuff, depending on what their mouth parts are. So I always show this in the lower 48 states, and people think that's a drill bit, you know. But that's just a set of spatulas, and it just waves water containing bacteria into the mouth of the protozoa. This guy is eating the insides of another little ball-peen hammer, and what happens is it just pushes her into and sucks the cytoplasm out. Here's one just eating directly another nematode, and this is one that eats a dog. We don't talk about that one. So what you got going on in the soil, basically, is this gigantic eating situation. We have the bacteria and fungi attracted by the exudates of the plant who get eaten by the nematodes and the protozoa, and they poop out the excess in the rhizosphere, which is low in carbon. This attracts all these life, and everything happens in there, and the plant is able to absorb the excess pooped out nitrogen. That's how the system works. The nitrogen that's pooped out is always in ammonium form, always nitrogen ammonia, NH4, always. If you've got soil, and so always, okay, if you've got soil that has a lot of bacteria in it, the pH is above 7, so you have a lot of bacteria, you end up with bacteria that fix nitrogen. And if they fix nitrogen through a two-step process with the archaea, and that turns into nitrates, okay? If the soil stays fungally dominated with a pH below 7, the ammonium stays in ammonium form. There's two kinds of nitrogens for plants. And it turns out that plants can live off of either one, but some plants like one form of nitrogen and some plants like the other form of nitrogen. They'll live off of either one. They prefer one over the other. And the deal is, it's like your TV clicker and your CD player. They're supposed to work on the same damn clicker. It doesn't, you know, one clicker always works better with a TV and one always works better with the other one. So it's the same thing, but they can eat both. They prefer one over the other. And notice that this is green nitrates. This is brown ammonium. Okay. So how do you tell what your plants like? Because obviously you want to give the plants what you like. Well, the hard way is to look at the succession scale. You start out, you have nothing but bacteria, no fungi. And as things begin to grow and then start to decay, they attract fungi into the area. And so as you go over this way, the bacteria stays about the same the whole time, 100% bacteria. But over here, you keep getting more and more fungi. You end up with, 10,000 to 1 more fungi than bacteria in the old growth situation. And you can actually walk in forests and smell ammonium as you walk around in the right forests. Particularly in the tropics, I have to say. That's too complicated, because what you'd have to do under that system, is you'd have to figure out, where is your apple tree? Where is it in there? Who cares? Because here's an easy way. Things that are in the ground for less than a year, and I include bulbs because there's a new bulb produced each year underneath the old bulb. Things that are in the ground for less than a year, they like nitrates, green nitrates. Things that are in the ground for more than a year, they like fungally dominated soil. Okay, they don't need as many nitrogen-fixing bacteria. So perennials, trees, and shrubs. More than a year, less than a year. Really simple. Okay, and your lawn happens to like half and half. Okay, so when you leave your grass clippings down, green, and then you run your leaves over instead of raking them up, brown, you feed your lawn. All right, so that's kind of the system right there. All in the book, don't have to take any notes. How do you know whether you got the bigger guys, even though you might not want to look at your nematodes and you can see whether you have bigger guys that eat the nematodes and the protozoa. And you do that by making something known as a Berlaise funnel. And you can do that by taking a pop bottle, cutting it in half, putting it in upside down. You put a little screen here. Now, my wife was away at Yale. True Value Hardware wasn't open at 10 o'clock at night. And so I went to my kitchen screen. That's the right size to use. You can cut out a little teeny piece and use it. And then you can repair it a little bit, although not that well. And so my wife's wondering, what happened there? I've never told her. But anyway, so you take some duff from your soil, your soil duff, or you take a little bit of the top, a couple of inches. You put it underneath the light like that. The heat from the light causes the organisms to go down through the screen, down into the cup, and then you look at the cup to see what you have. And depending on what you have in that cup, that'll tell you whether you have the protozoa and the nematodes. If you have the protozoa and the nematodes, then you must have bacteria and fungi, because that's what they eat. So, and it's an amazing sight to see. And I always tell people, if you're squeamish about putting your hands in the ground with things that have teeth and tails that bite, I'm telling you right now, it's scary. All sorts of things in there that you may not want to see. This is why people wear gloves, I guess, when they go, like a Japajid. Look at that little biting tail, huh? These guys eat fungi. Here's a springtail. They eat fungi as well. And they're all over your lawns. You just don't recognize them most of the time. They have a little fulcrum there. And if you walk up too close to them, or one of these guys gets too close to them, that fulcrum is pushed out, and these things can jump 10 feet. So you see these little things jumping all over the place. If you have them, you've got good fungal in your lawn. Then you've got mites. Some of the mites eat fungus. Some of the mites eat bacteria. Some of the mites eat other mites. Some of the mites eat you. But if you've got mites, then you've got a pretty good population. And you want to have a diversity of this stuff. And so you take a look at it through a magnifying glass, or hopefully you'll buy a macroscope, which I'm involved with and sell and can eat if you buy one. And you look at what's in there and you go, whoa, fabulous. But you don't know what it is because they don't teach us names of these things. So what you need to do is buy a book, not mine, a book that every gardener needs to have. It's by a guy named James Nardi. He's a professor, adjunct professor at University of Southern Illinois, called Life in the Soil. And it's basically a bird book for insects and crawly, creepy things that are in the soil. Identification book. And I wish he'd give me, excuse me?
The author's name?
N-A-R-D-I, James Nardi. And I've never met him. I've talked to him on the phone a couple of times because I think he suddenly found out that I'm talking about his book. He says, I know exactly where you are in the country. I go to Amazon Central Authors, have this little thing we can go to, and it tells us where our books are selling. And he says, I always know where you're speaking because every time you speak, I sell a case of books. You know, and I keep saying, the name of my book is, you know, anyway, so you have all these great things in there. When my son and I did this, my son has 2 degrees from Stanford, 1 degree from MIT. He's not a stupid guy. We fought over the microscope, the macroscope, for about an hour and a half. It was like looking at a Roman Colosseum and, you know, the gladiators, I mean, the Christians, and it was incredible, the eating and fighting and stuff that goes on in that little cup. Unbelievable. And gardeners need to know what we have there. So those guys are in there. And everything's part of the soil food web. The slug that runs around and eats your hosta, you know, I say let it eat the hosta because I hate them. Incidentally, hostas are edible, so maybe that's what we ought to be doing is eating them. But I don't like these variegated plants. It's just me. But everyone you see above ground, there's 5 or 6 of them down below ground breaking down dead material, making it available for the fungus, making it more available for bacteria. When they travel around in the soil, and incidentally, just like the mites and all those other little guys, they're making tunnels and crawling around, and you know, and they're making air spaces. When it rains, the bad air gets pushed out, good air comes in, water reservoirs, blah, blah, blah. And these guys, as they run around, they're sticky, more soil structure. And then they run around and they end up, they're taxicabs. They have all the fungal spores on them. They take and they got all sorts of mites and little guys and bacterium. So they travel around in the soil and they do all this kind of stuff. And I always say, I never give gardening advice in this talk, except for this. Don't put the beer trap in the garden or the yeast trap in the garden like they tell you to, you know, because what you're doing is you're attracting the slugs into your garden. They'll travel a mile to come into your garden. So you put it 10 feet outside the garden, don't put it in the garden. All right, and they're not that bad. If you see them, they're not that bad because at least 5 out of the 6 are eating dead stuff. So you gotta keep them. Then we have worms, which are not native to Alaska. I can't tell you how many calls I get now in the summertime and more every year about these things, these castings. People say, what are those little things in my lawn? I go, how do I get rid of them? Get rid of them. Vacuum them up and bring them to my house, please. You know, I mean, it's just. Worms are just alchemists, but before we even get to the alchemy, I mean, what they're doing is they're blind. They are sensitive to light. They come up, and they bring stuff down into the soil. They bring organic matter into the soil because they don't want to work on the surface. They only come up when it rains or in the light time. But they want to go back down into the soil. They've got this unbelievable, uncanny capabilities and abilities. If you put an umbrella and tried to pull an open umbrella down into the ground, it wouldn't go. If you flip the umbrella over the other way, you know, it would collapse and come down into the hole. These guys know how to turn leaves around. They're blind. They don't have any hands, but they can turn the leaf around so that it'll come down into the hole. And they bring them down. They make these beautiful burrows. This, you know, good air comes in, pushes the bad air out, water reservoirs. Then they have these burrows where they keep a lot of this organic material that's down there, acts as reservoirs. So they're fabulous for making soil structure. They are also taxicabs, got all sorts of stuff on them. And these castings are phenomenal. And it is amazing that so many people up here have never seen a worm because they're not native here. They're not native to the United States. They were brought over by the Pilgrims and the ballast and then, you know, Johnny Appleseed spreading them around and all that kind of stuff. But what goes in the worm and comes out the back end is not the same thing because they concentrate. They concentrate the goodies. And so what comes out of those in those castings, that's why they're so valuable. That's why people use vermicompost and worm castings. Phenomenal guys. And then, of course, you've got, you know, the bigger guys that are running around the soil, making holes and passing good air rolling in. How do you know whether you've got, the bigger guys? You just take some soil and throw it in a bucket of water. See what floats to the top. You'd be amazed at what floats to the top. Look at your nardi. You'd be able to identify a lot of the mites and ants and all sorts of things that you've got in there that are running around, making pore space, creating more soil structure, keeping diversity, keeping these in check, doing all that great stuff. So you got everything as part of the soil. Anything on your property. A little frog bounces around. He's carrying all sorts of stuff on it. We all know what bears do in the woods. And then you've got dung beetles. In Australia, as Roger may have mentioned yesterday, I don't remember, they brought in the prisoners, and then they brought in the cattle for the prisoners to take care of. They couldn't get rid of the dung. It wouldn't go away. I mean, they were walking around in dung. Wherever they had cattle, the dung was there. It wouldn't go away. It stank. It was slippery, you know, terrible stuff. They didn't have dung beetles to take the dung out. Oh, who thought about that? So finally, a guy went over to Africa, and he brought back, they had kangaroo dung beetles, but they didn't work. Koala bear dung beetles, they didn't work. So a guy went over to Africa. I think he brought back elephant dung beetles, and they worked okay. And then he finally figured it out and brought back cattle dung. I have a friend in Oregon who sells dung beetles around the world. He's got a dung beetle ranch. Wow. How'd you like to be married to him? Gotta go out and feed the, oh my God, gotta feed the Beatles deer, you know. Incredible. But this guy, as it travels around, incidentally, it has, you can't see it here, but they're mites, little red mites that are stuck to him. They hit the dung, the mites get off the dung beetle, and they eat the fly larvae that are competing with the dung beetle. So they bring their own artillery around with them, and they lay these landmines around. And then in 15 minutes, they can get in that dung, and it's gone. We have moose dung beetles. You know, we have dung beetles up here. So it's fascinating. And even the birds have something to do. They hop around. Protozoa touches the ground every time a bird touches the ground. So they're taxicabbing around. They got mites and all sorts of things on them you don't even want to think about. Heard my first robin yesterday, incidentally, so yes! But, you know, they might carry a worm and go fly a couple acres away and, you know, see another robin and want to talk to it and drop the worm. Taxicabs. Everything in the yard is part of the soil food web, including you. We're part of the soil food web. And unfortunately, we're not always a good part of the soil food web. So we do things like we use Miracle-Gro. Now, I can pick on Miracle-Gro. I'm going to very quickly tell the story. I met the guy who started Miracle-Gro. His name was Horace Hagedorn. We all met him at the Garden Writers. He came and gave a talk. And we were sitting there with a little box of Miracle-Gro he gave everybody. And he gave the talk. And he explained how he got in the business. He got in the business because he was an advertising graduate from the University of Pennsylvania. And he went to work in New York City in 1949 for a butter company. And he learned the first day on the job, all butter is USDA grade A, unless it's cooking butter, which means it's USDA grade B. But most butter is USDA grade A. It's just cut from big blocks into little sticks. And his job was to advertise this company's butter. How do you do that? It's all the same. So he immediately learned to hate his job. And he told us that he would get up in the morning after about the second week, and he'd look in the mirror with his Gillette Blue Blade razor, knowing that one of his friends was advertising for Gillette. You know, having a great time contemplating, 10 years in advance, five-bladed blades and all that kind of stuff. And here he was trying to sell butter. And he would look in the mirror and he would start to shave and he would think about cutting his jugular vein. And then he said that he wouldn't do it because he didn't want to make a mess that his landlord would have to clean up. So the next day he'd think about the other side, the other jugular vein. He said he drove to work after a while and every day he'd think about driving his car into the oncoming traffic. Hated his, but he didn't want to kill anybody else, just himself. So on the weekends, he'd drive around, and one day he drove around in New Jersey, and he came upon a greenhouse owned by a guy named Otto Stern. It used to be called Stern's Miracle-Gro. And he said to Otto, gee, you got some beautiful plants in here. Maybe we could do some business together. And they came up with the before and after Miracle-Gro ad, I guess Horace did, put it in the newspaper on a Sunday in 1953 or 4, and he made $20,000 by the following Thursday in cash in the mail. So on the following Friday, he went to the butter company and he quit. He said, I hate this job. I like you guys, I hate this job. So he quit. So then he went on to explain how several years later, Scott's lawn tried to take him over. He pulled a quickie on him and did a reverse buyout and bought Scott's for $365 million just using his private stock in Miracle-Gro. Yowzer, huh? Scott's was pretty damn surprised when in came the new management, I can tell you that right now. But in any case, he was a great guy. And so we all, after he gave the talk, we all went up to say hello to him and get our autograph on that very box of Miracle-Gro. The number one recognized item in the world, Miracle-Gro. Okay. Not sold in Japan, but everywhere else. So there we are, and he's about this big, bald, looked like Norman Rockwell character, he looks up and he sees me and he goes, oh my God, I'm so sorry I told the story about the butter company. See, it turns out my father and grandfather owned it. Yeah, and so we were always very friendly with him, and we were very organic, except for this. We used Miracle-Gro. Now, Miracle-Gro works. There's no question that Miracle-Gro works. This stuff is phenomenal. But the reason why it works is it's a chemical sponge. Okay, and it's so highly concentrated, just a teeny little bit of it has to touch the root. It feeds the plant for 2 weeks. You read the label. It says for 2 weeks. That's all you need to do, just a little bit of Miracle-Gro. How come only 2 weeks? I'm going to show you why. Because, and I won't just pick on them, I'll pick on any brand, they're salts. Okay, if you learn anything in 10th grade other than identify a paramecium, you learn that nature wants to have an equilibrium. And so if you have a cell that has water in the inside of it, and you have a powder on the outside that doesn't have water in it, or has salts in it, Well, the water wants to go outside the shell to dilute the salt. The salt wants to go inside the cell to dilute the water, and you end up with an equilibrium and a dead cell, okay, because it breaks the cell wall. So, well, you know, what happens is you put Miracle-Gro down, it kills off the fungal hyphae, goes into the tomato root, because there's nothing there to protect it. So that's the first thing that's wrong with these guys. They're salts. They kill off the bottom level of the soil food web. And when it's gone, they're in the pooping and the eating. So you have to take over. That's why it says every 2 weeks you have to reapply. Oh, what a business Horace found, huh? Wow, phenomenal. You know, and then we do things like rototilling. Now, rototilling is a guy thing. It's the, you know, motorcycle we're not allowed to ride. And here in Anchorage, Alaska, most people go out and rent one. You know, you rent one, and you get it for 4 hours. And so for 3 hours and 45 minutes, you're going like this. First, you're going like this, you know, and then you do it once. Then you go this way and that way. And this, the last time, you're like this, keeping your feet out so that you won't make any footprints in it. And God forbid, by the time you take that thing back to the rental place, Stefan Tool or wherever it is, if your spouse walks into the garden and dog or kid makes footprints in there, you know, it just drives you nuts, okay? But what you've done is you've pulverized that garden. You can put your arm up in here. It's beautiful, fluffy stuff, okay? Uh-oh, what happened to that fungal network? It's gone. What happens to the bacteria that's supposed to be down there? They're up here. When you cut a worm in half, you don't get two worms. You get one live worm if you hit the 17th or 18th segment. Not doing very well, but normally you get two dead worms, two halves of a worm dead. You know, you just completely screw up the structure, you screw up the microbiology, you screw up the biology, all right? And that's a guy thing. And then what happens? It rains. And then we get snow and ice, you know, and it pushes the air out of the garden. And pretty soon, you begin to get these little anaerobic pockets in your garden. Now, the reason why we rototill is because of a guy named Jethro Tull, not the band. He was that was named after a guy who wrote. He was an English lawyer. He inherited an estate during the time of Jefferson, Adams, Franklin, Madison. They all read his stuff. He believed that plant roots ate soil. So if you pulverized it up, they'd eat it. Hey, perfect, okay? Pulverize it up, rototill it. That's why we rototill. It made sense in the United States when we were just taking virgin forest, dominated by fungal, and breaking it down, because we wanted to grow tobacco and broccoli and, you know, annuals to feed ourselves. It made a lot of sense to take that, and so it worked, but we continued to do it. You only need to rototill once to make it bacterially dominated, and then you never have to do it ever again. Plants will grow up through cement. We've all seen it happen. But in any case, it starts to get these anaerobic pockets. Doesn't always happen the first year, you know, and when you get anaerobic pockets, then you start producing alcohols. And things start to happen. Your plants don't grow as big, you know, and the bad guys start to come out, and you end up with things, maybe not the first year or second year or third, you end up with things you don't know where the hell they are. Where'd they come from? Like a case of toilet paper flipperophorus, you know? I mean, I had a daughter for 14 years, and all of a sudden I wake up one morning and 8 acres are covered with toilet paper, and still finding it, you know, 15, 20 years later. You know, so what do you do? Well, you know, if you're like most people, you get in the car and you go ask the genius at Lowe's or Home Depot, what should I put on my whatever it is? And of course, that highly educated person tells you what to put on. You don't read the label because they're too small. You can't, you know, or you don't have a knife to cut the label and open it up. So of course, you don't suit up. You spray, and because we live in Alaska, geez, short season, might as well spray twice and get it over with early, you know. And you're hitting the beneficials as well as the bad guys, so you're starting to kill more parts of the soil food web, because none of these things are just exclusive, you know. And then, you know, of course, keep your dog off the lawn, because you're putting down Weed Be Gone. Dog, you know, look up dog in Long Island and spleen cancer, and you'll see why, but dog? Who cares about the damn dog? Our kids are playing on our lawns, particularly here in Alaska, you know, and we know that without question that the things we're using on our lawns are bad. You can't walk in your house, according to the EPA and the label that you didn't read, if you spray your lawns with Weed Be Gone with the same shoes on. For the rest of the season, you don't walk in the house with, you know, because you're carrying the stuff in the house. You have grandkids or kids. George Bush drops that pretzel, puts it in his mouth. You know, you're picking up the stuff. And so, you know, you end up with some terrible, terrible things, and we put the stuff on our food because, you know, who wants that pepper? You know, we kind of grow peppers, but we don't want to have blemishes on them, or an apple or a carrot with a cut in it. And so we use all this stuff, and then we wonder why breast cancer in this country is, you know, 9 to 1. Your chances of getting, you know, 1 out of 9 women are going to get breast cancer. I think I gave my wife breast cancer, literally. from the chemicals that I use. I told you, 23 of them have been removed from the market by the manufacturer, including Saigon 2H, or Saigon 2E. Remember that for the aphids, right? Great stuff until you try to put it in a styrofoam cup, and 30 seconds later, there's no cup left. Oh my God, you know, so you wipe your hands off and then you just go put some more in, you know, I mean, and we want, you know, and people play golf and they're on the golf course, the guys are on the golf course, they think there's a potential link between prostate cancer and golf now. Yeah, you're on the ninth hole and you can't find the thing that washes the ball, so you lick it. People do it. Or worse, after you drink at the ninth hole and you're on the 14th hole and you have to go to the bathroom, you go up against a tree. But your hands have golf lawn chemical on them. Ooh, okay, something to think about. Anyway, so what do you do? Well, here's what you do. You put the stuff back in the, and you put the soil food web back again, and it's so easy. You use compost, you use mulches, and you use compost teas. All of these things can be made either fungally dominated or bacterially dominated. It's in the book. Or in the right conditions, you put the ectomycorrhizal or the endomycorrhizal fungi back again because they get killed off by the Miracle-Gros, et cetera, et cetera. And here, you use them because we're not sure we have all the ones we need. All right, compost, real quick. Has all the nematodes and protozoa. I mean, these are the fertilizer spreaders and all of the fertilizer bags you could possibly want to have in unbelievable quantities. The best gardens in the Anchorage, in Alaska, in the world are compost gardens. And if you use compost, you don't have to use anything else ever. You just have to put down a little bit on the surface, maybe half an inch, maybe an inch in some instances, lawn or gardens, and that's it. The microbiology and the biology work it in. You don't have to work it in. In like 8 months, it's 18 inches down, so you don't have to worry about it. You just spread it down. It's great stuff. The problem is you got to have a spouse to turn your pile. And if you have a big farm, you know, or a big garden, you got to have a lot of compost. And you have to know where it comes from. Because if it's not made properly, it can be doing damage. If it's not made properly, the tetracycline doesn't go away. That's in the feed or in the manure from the cow that was, you know, and you end up getting perhaps some tetracycline on the leaves as the plant goes through it, and you get sick when you eat your lettuce, you don't know why. You know, it's not just tetracycline, it's all sorts of stuff. So if it doesn't smell good, you don't know where it's coming from, don't buy it. It's got to be beautiful, or make it yourself, as Ellen will show you how. Okay, worm vermicompost, we've been through it. It is phenomenal stuff, and the reason is, Chris, those great things. And best gardens in the world, compost gardens, simple as that. Now, one of the other problems is it doesn't stick to leaves, and so people have come up with this concept of aerated compost teas, which you're all familiar with because you read the column, and it's wonderful, wonderful stuff. You can spray it on anything. You can't use too much of it. You can make a one-gallon bucket of it and use it on an entire acre because you can dilute it five times. You can't, you know, it doesn't burn anything. It is alive, and so it's got to be used pretty quickly. 4 hours, you know, after you buy it at Mill and Feed or from Allen or wherever, you should use it. And you can dilute it. You can make it yourself using these various different kinds of brewers. You can buy them all over the place. I'm sure Ellen sells one. I know they have them at Mill and Feed. The one I like, just for simplicity's sake, is the Kiss. Because it makes tea in 12 hours. You can come home on Friday. You know, the other ones take 24 hours, so you have to wait until Sunday. So I like that one. But does it work? Very controversial. One of the things Dr. Elaine's going to be doing is obviously making Rodale do some studies. There's a team that won the state championship in Connecticut where you're not allowed to use chemicals in schools. And they put compost tea down the field in the summertime to test it out. Not 50-yard line, but halfway, all the way down the field on one side. They discovered after never winning a game in 10 years that if they played their plays on the compost tee side, their cleats stuck in the ground. The other side was hardpan. Yeah. They won every home game, and they won the state championship in Connecticut as a result of compost tee. My lawn never, ever, ever had any fertilizer on it. Compost tee two or three times, leave the grass clippings down, worms like you can't believe. Beautiful lawn, lots of day. This is John Evans, 27-pound. He's got 14 Guinness Book of Records. I bring this because of this little zucchini here, which I took down to the Seattle Flower Show about 4 years ago. You know, Alaska Airlines says 50 pounds is your limit. That weighed 47 pounds, so it went in its own suitcase. When I got it to the show and opened it up, there was a little card in there from the TSA, and it said, we've been through your luggage. You know, you've seen that card. And then attached to it, and I think we can say this on the radio, it went, holy manure, spelled S-H-I-T. So they do have a sense of humor at the TSA. Nice big color. Okay, so you can make the compost fungally dominated or bacterially dominated by adding more brown, more green stuff. You can do mulches, and you can do mulches same way, fungally dominated or not, depending on what you're growing. Green stuff, grass clipping, straw, finely shredded material, kitchen waste, green stuff. Okay, has lots of sugar in it. Okay, hay when it's cut is green. If you want brown stuff for fungi, wood, leaves, bark, hard to digest stuff, brown stuff, full of lignin. And of course, there are no bare soils in nature. So there shouldn't be any bare soils in your yard. Annuals, green stuff. Peonies, brown stuff. Vegetables, right, hay is green. Straw is green, not hay, don't have seeds in it. Around your trees, which want to be fungally dominated, you got them in a lawn that wants to be 50-50, make it fungally dominated. Brown stuff around your trees. Don't touch the trunk because you don't want to digest the bark there. What falls down underneath the plant is supposed to fall down underneath the plant. That's nature's way of feeding the system. We come along and rake it up. Now, not here, but in the lower 48 states, people, as Roger Kuh says, you know, these blow and go. The reason why they blow? You're not at home. And how are you going to know whether they were even there if they leave everything on the ground? So they blow. But they shouldn't, and you shouldn't either. What falls down is supposed to stay there, simple as that. And then, of course, in places where they don't have them, where you've killed them off using chemicals, you need to repair the mycorrhizal situation and add them. Real quick, that's what they look like. They're different kinds. There are only about 12 commercial ones out of the 350 that we know, but they're different mixes. You know, they usually say vegetable, blah, 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 so you pretty well tell what they are. Do they work? Yeah, they work like crazy. Hey, here's how they work. Here's two seedlings sitting in the sun. One wants a duck. So he says, all right, give me a duck. So it mixes the right mix for the exudate, goes out, puts it in the ground, and catches a fungus. And the fungus goes out and catches the duck. Simple as that. All right, and then stays there, continuing to feed the plant, so the plant gets bigger. And they're really cool organisms, because what happens is, if there's two plants next to each other, they'll share their mycorrhizal network. So you can have a plant in the shade and a plant in the sun, they'll both be doing the same thing, because they're sharing food from the mycorrhizal system. They can store water, but the most important thing is they contain this coating called glomalin, discovered in 1996, discovered 2 years ago to be the main source of carbon in soil. All right, glomalin. Looks like this when it's stained, very sticky, helps create structure, sticks together, makes pores, air blows in, blows out, blah, 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 blah. And it's fabulous stuff because it has two carbon sites on it. It's a glycoprotein. Not one, but two, so it's got tremendous amounts of carbon. It provides rigidity for the fungi. It solidifies leaks that are in them, and it seals gaps. So it's really important stuff, which is why it produces it. And so soil food web gardeners, we look at things differently, okay? And by God, if you're not a soil food webby, you are not a good gardener. That's just all there is to it. No pesticides. We don't need them. There are biopesticides you can use if you have to, but no chemicals. They're just not needed. It's just gardening, folks. It's just gardening. It's a hobby, even though we eat it and we depend on it. It's not life or death for most people. Why we would want to put chemicals on it, which would make it death or death, I don't know, but we do. It's not fertilizer, it's microbe food. You're feeding microbes that are feeding the plants. We can't call it that because we've got state laws that prevent us from doing so. It's two forms. It always comes in two forms, either poop or fish. Okay? There's even one called poop and fish. They're good stuff. They're organic. You want to use things with numbers below 10, 10, 10. Because if the numbers are too high, the plant says, why am I making these exudates? The guy's going to feed me every 2 weeks. Why am I wasting my energy on making exudates, particularly phosphorus, that middle number? So if you have numbers over 10, 10, 10, you're going to be jeopardizing the ability of the plant to attract or to make the situation where you're going to get all of this carbon production from your mycorrhizal fungi. For if you're a farmer, it's 50 parts per million or lower. So you want to be real careful below 10, 10, 10. And there are certain foods that are great, certain foods that make fungal critters happy, and these are what they are. Manures, guano, alfalfa pellets, oh, this is for bacteria, alfalfa pellets, meal, manures, vermicompost, molasses, fish emulsions, these are fabulous for bacteria, okay? These are the ones that you want to have for fungi, humic and fulvic acids, fish meals, cold water. This is my favorite, soybean meal is my favorite. This is what I use in indoor plants, oatmeal. Oatmeal feed your indoor plants because they're perennials. They're in the ground for more than a year, they like brown stuff.
Put it in a blender?
Just grind it up, yeah. Or I use baby oatmeal, it's already blended. No rototilling. You want glomalin? Don't rototill. Simple as that. least amount of disturbance as possible. The first thing that dies in your soil are the fungal when it gets compacted. So you want to aerate your lawn every now and then, which nobody ever did until about 3 or 4 years ago. Maybe once every 5 years. How do you know if you got the soil food web good guys? You look for the big guys. And if you got the bigger guys, you got the littler guys. This is Mary Appelhoff. Worms eat your garbage. She died of breast cancer. I killed her too. I mean, we use chemicals, we're killing ourselves. That's just all there is to it. This is where it's coming from. I'm convinced it's coming from gardeners and farmers, you know, and it's bad, bad stuff. So we really need to do it. If you're not convinced, I leave you with this thought. You know, the redwoods, the Chugach forest, the redwoods, 500 years old, 371 feet tall. How did they get that big without anybody spraying Miracle-Gro on them? You know, they teamed with without ever reading the book, they teamed with microbes. But you should read the book, and I thank you very much. You're a great audience. Yeah.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with garden writer Jeff Lowenfels. His talk, entitled Teeming with Microbes, was the second program in our three-part series featuring presentations from the Alaska Botanical Garden 5th Annual Spring Garden Conference, recorded on March 12, 2011. Next week, hear from Master Gardeners Verna Pratt on growing Alaska wildflowers in your home garden and Julie Riley on the culture of gardening. That's next week on Addressing Alaskans, Thursday at 2 p.m., repeating at 7 p.m. on KSKA. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.